episode 17 of Two Chairs Talking, a podcast that Perry Middlemiss and I started earlier this year, and we're still going. How are you, Perry?
Pretty good, thanks. Not too bad.
That's good. We're actually recording in the same location today because we couldn't get our combined schedules to work together so that we could do a separate recording. So we've managed to get together and talk in one spot, and it's always a good thing. I should apologise for the lower quality of the audio this time around. We're in an environment where we get a lot of echo, and I can't do much about that. So we apologise for that, but we'll hopefully improve next time around. I just wanted to start by saying that this will be our last episode for 2019. We'll be taking a break over the holiday period, and we'll be back in the new year, probably to do a survey of the best of 2019. I think that's what we have in mind.
Well, the best books we read.
Some of
the ones that I read in 2019 were from the early 1900s. So,
not necessarily the best of what was published. One of the best books I read this year was by George Eliot. So. Yeah, which is last century. Sorry, not even last century, the previous century than that.
A little while ago.
Indeed, a while ago. I had a little bit of follow-up. I was talking last episode about the TV series For All Mankind, which is run on Apple TV Plus, which is going very well. We're enjoying it so far. But I did make a mistake when I was talking about episode 2, where they talk about Wernher von Braun. And I think I might have indicated or given the impression that Wernher von Braun was in fact disgraced and tossed out of NASA in the real world. In fact, that wasn't the case.
Okay.
Those things really came to the public knowledge well after he'd left NASA. And it just occurred to me that one of the issues with anything which is alternate history, where you're sort of messing with the real facts of history, is that you've kind of, the reader or the viewer's kind of got to know the real history in order to really get it. And I suppose it's a bit of a problem with writing or filming alternate history. If you don't know the real history, then you may just go right over your head.
Could do. But I suppose in this instance, we're talking about something that has changed from something I would have thought that was fairly solidly in the public's consciousness, the space race. I mean, I know that the people of our age in particular, who basically lived through the whole thing and remember just about every single bit that ever happened, I don't think there'd be a problem for any of us. I mean, some of the younger ones might not know the nuances. Mm. I mean, didn't you tell me once when you went to see Apollo 13 and the woman selling the tickets, might have been you or somebody else, told me that the woman selling you the tickets said, "Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I want to know what happens." And he's sort of like, this is a
recreation. You would have thought someone knew. Yeah,
a recreation of a real event. We should really have known about that one. But there's a lot of things that people just don't know that you and I just take for granted. That you know, everybody should know part of this history. Mm. And because we were science fiction fans back in the 60s and 70s. This stuff was just like, just nectar to us. We just sucked this stuff up the whole time. Basically, writing to NASA to get, small pieces of press material that they handed out for kids who were interested, and basically just watching it, keeping scrapbooks of all the Apollo missions. And now, as you put me onto this little podcast called Liftoff,
yes,
where they are gradually working their way through all of the Apollo missions, and have just done Apollo 12. Mm. And that was interesting. There was stuff that happened in Apollo 12 that I had completely forgotten about. Yes. But now that I know about this, it's really quite interesting.
Sure, yeah. I haven't caught up with that. So, yeah, I'm way behind with my podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, no, that's really quite a good one. And it's good to listen to it in a sort of slightly different way that they handle it. They don't go into the all the ins and outs. They just assume that you know all the good stuff that happened.
Yeah.
And what they're going to do is they're going to tell you all the quirky little bits behind the scenes that you don't actually know what was going on. And I think that's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting to do that. So, yeah.
But also listening to that at the same time as watching For All Mankind is quite good because you're getting a very different view, although that I'm not sure how far you're up to, but you'll be aware that, as we mentioned previously, the premise of this is that Russia beats the US to the moon by about a month.
Yeah.
And then their second mission, have you seen the second mission? The second mission for the Russians?
Oh, where
they put a woman on the moon.
A woman on the moon, yes, for sure.
I'm going to be careful here, listener, because David is not up to, hasn't watched as much as I have.
I've seen episode 4, I think.
I'm up to episode 8, so okay. I won't say much else. But basically, I think around about episode 2 or 3 after that, they actually jump forward a year or two.
Yeah.
So things are a little bit more down the track.
Yeah.
Because all the rest of the next bit is basically theoretically following along where Apollo is just doing what it was doing. Mm-hmm. But they had to plan a fair way in advance to start making changes.
Sure.
And so the TV series is an alternate history from the shock of the Russians landing there first and then moving on. We still don't know yet what that particular point is.
No, the Russians off on a different track. Yeah,
yeah, where the divergence point is. I think it's basically because of the guy that I mentioned last time, the head of the Russian space program. I would say that he probably does not die and just carries on.
Mm.
Because certainly the Russian program, while it didn't go into the doldrums, was not as robust and as energetic after his death.
Mm.
And they basically really struggled and they couldn't get their major heavy lifter off the ground.
Mm.
And every time they tried it, it either blew up or it just wouldn't work.
But
that guy would have actually got it done, I think. Yeah. He probably would have been able to figure out how to harness all the resources around him to kick it off.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the thing.
They may or may not tell us.
No, they may not. No, they may not have to.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things like you go to alternate histories are really popular in the science fiction genre, of course. And there are times when you're reading the book or the novel or the set of short stories, you really don't actually know.
Mm.
And the only way that you can find out is when one of the characters tells somebody else about what happened in the past, and you go, hang on a minute, that didn't happen.
Yeah, right.
So somewhere around that point, you know, but if you don't know that history,
that's right,
you don't know where the nuance is, and you miss out on it. Yeah, so that's okay.
Yeah, that's true. I'm a big fan, well, I was a big fan, I haven't read these books for quite a while, but I'm a big fan of Harry Turtledove, who's so often dubbed the king of alternate history.
He seems to do them all the time.
He does. He's very prolific. But I liked his one, which starts with, which is about the South winning the Civil War in 1862 or something. They win, but he actually starts with a little prologue, which is very clever, and it's about this chap delivering a set of important battle plans from the South. He's a Southern soldier, and he's delivering these battle plans, and they're just wrapped around a bunch of cigars. And in the prologue of this, he drops the bundle of cigars and is about to ride off. And one of the Southern soldiers, I say, you've just dropped this package. Oh, my God, you know, that could be disastrous. It would be terrible. And he rides off with the battle plans. Now, in the actual real history, he really did drop the battle plans wrapped in the cigars. And they really were found by the Northern forces. And that did have an effect. So it's very clever the way that it plays out. So anyway, he's very good at doing that sort of thing.
So basically there's a long stream of alternate histories all the way right through science fiction, which we should hit them at some point.
Yeah, we should do it as a theme.
It's one of those themes like Generation Starships and alternate histories. And the big funny thing, of course, in the last 20 or so odd years was that Philip Roth wrote this book called, I think it was The Plot Against America.
Mm.
And he thought he had created this whole new genre of fiction. Basically it was these alternate histories. But no, he had no idea because he hadn't read about them. But there's been quite a lot.
Mm.
Bring the Jubilee by Ward Moore is a classic.
There's some very early ones.
Yeah. The one that I like, that I actually quite liked, was by Randall Garrett. This was the major first novel in the series. He didn't really write quite a lot of them. It was mostly short stories. They're about a character called Lord Darcy,
who's
his major sort of Sherlock Holmes-style character, but it's in a world in which magic works, but works on a very, very strict scientific basis. And this is all based on a history where Richard the Lionheart does not die in the Crusades, but comes home, kicks John out, and then everything sort of stays. And if you think about it, the Magna Carta's not signed. And so Parliament doesn't really get kicked off. It still stays with the royals, and that's always runs all the way right through. And they're a very interesting series of stories, which I should go back and reread.
I like those a lot.
I haven't read those for 30-odd years.
Well, I probably read them a little bit more recently, but it would be a good 15 years at least before, since I've seen, I last read them. Oh, that's a little interesting little diversion. Have you been reading anything interesting we should talk about?
Yes, I have. I read this year's winner of the World Fantasy Award, Witchmark, which is also possibly an alternate history. It's hard to tell. It's set in a sort of an Edwardian European world, just around the time of a world war, where, and it's a world where witches and mages exist. But in the country in which this particular novel is set, witches are basically rounded up and put into mental institutions because it's believed that the witches will go mad and they won't be able to control it. But mages are okay. They can basically have the, they have the strength of character to be able to to be able to control things. And
the theme right here.
Oddly enough, all the mages happen to be in the aristocracy, and all the witches happen to be the lesser classes. And nobody seems to pick this up until one particular member of the aristocracy who's basically done a runner. He's really sort of taken off and gone off to the war to use his skills, which are reasonably minor, as a doctor. And then after the war is over, has come back, and he is attempting to fix all of the men that have come back from the war with what looks like battle fatigue or, you know, sort of war stress. But he believes that there's something else going on, and he finds a very large conspiracy in the world that, in which he lives, where the aristocracy are basically manipulating the lesser classes, as you would have expected. It's quite a good book. It's a debut, so it was really quite well done for a debut novel. I think it was also nominated for a Nebula Award this last year, and so it has a bit of kudos going there. It's the first in a series. The one thing I really liked about it was a fantasy novel, and it was short. Less than 250 pages. And Cyril Polk, the author, was able to put everything she needed to into that world and into that series of magic, or that magical system, in a short space of time. It was really done very, very well, and I really quite enjoyed that. I thought that was great. What about you?
We raved last time, both of us raved last time, about a book called The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North. And so I enjoyed that so much, I thought I'd go on and read some more of her stuff. And so I read a book called The Sudden Appearance of Hope. And I can't right now off the top of my head say whether that was before or after the writing of Harry August. But anyway, what I really like about the way she writes is that she takes one really quite clever idea, and she just takes it to the ultimate degree of the logical consequences, how it would affect things, how it would affect people, how the protagonist, you know, would react to this, and then adds onto it more complex things, which are conspiracies and so on. And in this case, the sudden appearance of Hope, the protagonist is actually a young woman called Hope Arden. She gets forgotten. People start forgetting her when she's a teenager, or just growing up to become a teenager. And it gets to the stage where her parents will only set a certain number of places at the table, not including one for her. And her teachers start to never call her in class for anything, and forget to write reports on her and so on. And it goes on and on and on, and it gets worse and worse. In fact, it gets to the point where no one can ever remember her or their interactions with her. And the author just takes that one idea, really, which is one very clever idea, and just pursues it, and makes it into a really powerful, very clever book. And she then gets involved with a conspiracy against... there's like a Facebook-like, it's not quite Facebook, but it's there's an app or a system called Perfection, and it runs on an app on your phone. And you, if you sign up to Perfection, it tries to lead you to becoming a more and more perfect person, but perfect being defined as, you know, sort of the Hollywood ideal of what a perfect individual would be, you know, beautiful, beautifully groomed, beautiful clothes, not overweight, not underweight, all these things. And the app kind of does that, but it's actually quite, it's very intrusive. And the young woman who's the protagonist, the book sort of starts off with someone she's befriended committing suicide because she's been driven to distraction by this Perfection app. She can't actually meet these requirements. She can't actually become as perfect as the app is trying to make her get. And so the protagonist decides she's going to kind of take revenge on the people who are running this app. And then she comes across someone who really is trying to, in a almost like a terrorist kind of way, really attack the whole institution of Perfection and the people behind it. It's a pretty clever book, and I liked it a lot. I actually like it marginally better than Harry August, which is saying a good deal.
Yeah, well, no, yeah, I did really enjoy it. I thought it was a fantastic book. She's become a new favourite, I think. Mm-hmm. Although there's a few others that I need to go and have a look at.
Yeah, she's written quite a lot.
Yeah.
She started off writing young adult stuff, and there's a whole series of fantasy novels she wrote. It's sort of in the young adult level, and they may well be worth looking at. But I think they're more pure fantasy.
Yeah.
But these more adult books, they're full of intriguing ideas.
She does actually say take a good idea and then run with it. And it's really good stuff. And I think that she's certainly one that we need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The Hugo Time Machine.
And this time we're going to be talking about the year 1959. The winner of the novel was A Case of Conscience by James Blish. Didn't that already win?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a strange one, and one that I'm really not terribly happy about. We discussed a couple of episodes ago, A Case of Conscience, the novella, which won the Hugo Award a couple of years prior to this. The Case of Conscience, in this instance, the novel, is really just that novella plus the sequel plucked together to make up a novel and then put up again. Mm. I don't really like this idea very much. I think that if a major portion of the work has won a Hugo already, it shouldn't basically be shouldn't be up for another one.
No.
But we're talking here in 1959, where the awards were given out at Detention in Detroit. Detention in Detroit. Not really a greatest. It was a bit like the English convention in 87 being called Conspiracy, which I didn't think was a terribly good idea, especially when they had the Stravinsky brothers from Russia as their guests. Anyway, so Case of Conscience, it's basically the original novella, which we've discussed, and the sequel. In this instance, the alien that is brought back from the planet. The second novella deals with that particular alien and its time on Earth and how people try to manipulate it. Mm. I don't think it's quite as good as the first one, but obviously the voters at that particular convention decided it was the best one of the year. Mm. And oddly enough, David, we've actually got to the point now where the Hugos look like they're starting to look like the modern Hugos. Uh-huh. In the sense that we've got a winner, but we've also got a list of nominees, which is rather interesting.
Sure.
And the nominees were The Enemy Stars by Paul Anderson, Who by Algie Budrus, Have Space It Will Travel by Robert A. Heinlein, and Immortality, Inc. by Robert Shipley.
Mm.
All males again.
Mm-hmm.
So we still got basically the, you know, sort of old white male guys dominating. Not sure about what you think. Who is basically considered to be pretty much a classic?
It is a classic, but it's I'm not sure quite whether it's science fiction. It's really more like a Cold War thriller thing. I mean, it's science fiction in the sense that there's this particular person who is supposed to have had a terrible industrial accident in doing research, and while he's being captured by the Russians, and his face has been totally destroyed, and he wears this metal mask, and but then he's returned to the West. And the real issue is he really the original researcher who was captured by the Russians, or is he a Russian spy? And they've done this to his face so that the people who are trying to be convinced that he is the original get fooled and they can't tell. So it's the whole thing about is he really this original person, or is he not this original person? And that's really the whole play of the story. But it's quite good. It's an interesting book. And it leaves some questions hanging, which I think is quite nice. It's never quite certain about what the reality is. It's quite a good book.
How Space It Will Travel is really basically a young adult, it's one of his young adult adventure ones. I mean, he writes well. You may not necessarily like some of the plots and some of his devices and some of his characters, but he writes young adult stuff very, very well.
Yeah, I think so. Those juveniles were all pretty good, I think.
Anderson's The Enemy Stars is a space opera adventure set on a survival on a starship where the teleporter's broken down. It's basically vintage Anderson stuff, you know, space opera.
Mm.
I know I've read it.
I haven't read it recently, that's for sure.
Now, I should have read Shipley's Immortality Inc., which is also known as Time Killer, but I can't remember it.
Mm.
But the description I've got of it is that it's a near future science fiction about transferring consciousness into a dead body.
Yeah.
So I don't remember anything about it at all. I can't remember having read it.
No.
But Shipley, Heinlein, Budrus, Anderson, Blish.
It's a pretty good
line. It's a pretty strong list of characters, isn't it, basically?
Yeah.
You're looking at some strong writers, even though we are looking at it from a position in the 21st century where we have a little bit more of a feeling about diversity, and there isn't a lot of diversity.
No, not by this stage, no.
So no,
not.
Absolutely. Mm. There we go.
Yeah.
Novelette.
The Big Front Yard.
Yeah, The Big Front Yard by Clifford Simak. Which
I did manage to reread recently. So, yeah.
Published in Astounding in October 1958. Now, the other thing is that they also seem to have decided to award the Hugos for the previous year, finally. Yeah, you know, I've been ranting about this the last couple of times, where it seems to be you can't work out which bloody year these things are coming from. Well, it now seems to be that the novelette is based on stories that were published in 1958 and awarded in 1959. So The Big Front Yard was in Astounding in October 1958. The other nominees were Captivity by Zena Henderson, possibly one of her people stories, not sure. A Desk Full of Girls by Fritz Lieber.
No.
Miracle Workers by Jack Vance. Rat in the Skull by Rog Phillips. Keeps going. Mm. Second Game by Catherine McLean and Charles V. DeVette. So we've got we have a first woman nominee. Shark Ship, also known as Reap the Dark Tide by Sam Cornblith. And Unwillingly to School by Pauline Ashwell. Another female nominee.
Yeah,
I don't know Pauline Ashwell, but anyway, the...
Zena Henderson, was that another...
Captivity by Zena Henderson.
Yeah, so
there's
quite a few
female... My apologies about that. Fantasy and Science Fiction, June 1958. Mm. Anyway, The Big Front Yard by Clifford Simak.
Yeah.
This is classic Simak.
It's classic Simak. You can't read a couple of pages of his work without that being able to identify him as the author.
No, it's just
a certain style to how he writes.
He writes these sort of... He's always set basically in rural... Not always, but the ones that you remember. Yeah. Are sort of set in rural America where there's one bloke who's, you know, a bit of a jack-of-all-trades or a tinkerer or a mender or fixer or sorts who basically makes his own way, doesn't really have much in the way of familial attachments, probably isn't married, doesn't have kids, and that's exactly what you get here.
Mm.
This guy basically likes mending stuff and tries to fix things for people, and he gets all the stuff taken down into his basement where he sits to try and tinker with it. Somebody says that they've got this classic old black and white television they want him to fix, which is broken down. And he says, yeah, he'll do it, so they lug it all down into the basement and fix it all up. He has something that he has to do, goes away that day, comes back that night, and the TV's been fixed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not black and white anymore, it's now in colour.
Yes.
And he sort of thinks, hey, well, that's a bit interesting, I didn't expect that to happen. And then he suddenly realises that something's happened to his house.
Yes.
That something has been built into the structure of his house. And as he follows this, he can't basically drill into this material, and it seems to be sort of blocking off half his house.
Mm-hmm.
And he works out that he can get into his house easily from the back door, but the front door opens to a completely different world.
Yeah.
Absolutely completely different world that goes on and on forever, and he can just see out into the distance.
Which is the big front yard.
Yep, and then he decides that he's going to do a bit of investigation. So he's actually got his car in the front yard, which is useful because the car's there, so he gets into that and drives off. And basically heads off all the way across the landscape and passes a couple of little creatures that had walked out of his house sometime previously, which he'd noticed, and he comes across some structures and he opens a door on one of these structures and sees into another complete different world, which is... And he turns around and he's in bright sunshine and he looks through the door and it's completely dark and raining.
Mm.
And so he seems to come to this idea that there is a sort of a continuity of these connections between one world and another through these doors. So he gets back to his house, goes back there, and a little time later somebody turns up and it's this blue-skinned alien sitting on a sort of a hover bike who starts talking to him through the auspices of one of the blokes that works for this guy.
Yeah, and it's also a common thing in CIMAC is the sort of the idiot savant, or not really, he's not really an idiot, but it's a person who everybody looks down on, is dumb and doesn't understand things, but, you know, he's a hick and he's got something wrong with him mentally. But in fact, the thing that's wrong with him mentally enables him to communicate with these aliens, and therefore it becomes invaluable, so it's clever.
He kept on telling the main character that the main character's dog had found something.
Yeah, yeah, he was talking to the dog. Yeah.
He was talking to the dog. Yeah. Basically, he was actually talking to the dog. He could actually understand what the dog was trying to say to him.
Yeah.
And so he could understand what this blue alien's talking to him about. And then, of course, the authorities get wind of all this and they come down and try and take over the whole thing and he won't let it happen. And and then his mate says, no, this bloke's the only one that ever gave me any of the time of day and looked after me, so I'm only going to deal with him. If you don't use me, you can't talk to them.
Yeah, that's right.
So they've got him over a barrel. And this is classic CIMAC stuff, the little guy overthrows the big guy, and they have this. This is certainly a theme that will run through to his novel that won the Hugo, which is coming up in about 4 or 5 episodes of this. Waystation, which is one of my all-time favourites.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic. So we'll cover that a bit more often when that comes up.
Yeah.
I'm not really terribly up on the nominees, to be perfectly frank. The names are mostly familiar, other than Rod Phillips and Pauline Ashwell, but otherwise,
no.
I know those.
Yeah.
So best short story. So again, the thing that the change of this is, we've now got categories as well. So we've got the novel, the best novelette, and the best short story.
Yeah.
And the best short story is That Hellbound Train by Robert Bloch.
Yeah.
Have you read this one?
I have, yes. A long, long time ago. But it's actually very memorable. And it's about a guy who essentially sells his soul to the devil. But the clever trick of it is that what he asks in return for his soul is this magic watch that when he presses the button on the watch, time will freeze at that moment, and he's going to wait until, he thinks he's tricked the devil because he's going to wait until some absolutely perfect moment of his life, and he'll push the button and he'll endure that for all eternity, and he'll never have to go to hell. But of course, he never quite gets to the point where he wants to push the button. He's never got that absolutely perfect moment happening. And so, but in the end, he finds himself on his way to hell on that hellbound train. And then the punchline, of course, is this is when he pushes the button.
Because he really likes trains. Well, he really likes being on this train.
Well, he likes the company,
I think. Yeah, I think so, yeah. So, look, it's a neat story. Overly memorable? Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, the nominees. The Advent on Channel 12 by C.M. Cornbluth. The Edge of the Sea by Algy Budrus again. The Man Who Murdered Mohammed by Alfred Bester. Now, this is one of the all-time great time travel stories, short stories. Absolutely. Oh, right. It's all about, basically, it's one particular person decides that, what happens is, he's a physicist working in a university somewhere in the US. Comes home unexpectedly one day to find his wife in the arms of another lecturer or somebody or other. And rather than doing anything, he decides, right, he's going to fix this. So he goes down into his basement and invents a time machine, as you do, in about half an hour, and travels back in time to try to kill his wife's grandfather. With the understanding, of course, that if he kills the wife's grandfather, then the wife would never be born and he'd never meet her, never marry her, and that everything would be fine and he wouldn't have to worry about it. And he'd be long gone because he'd kill grandfather, get away, nobody will ever basically suspect it because he won't be in that time zone. And, you know, if he kills his wife, everybody will go straight for him. Oh, it's the husband who did it, of course. So he does this, goes back, kills the wife's grandfather, comes back. And there she is. She's still there. Well, this is any good. So he goes back and starts, kills the grandfather, the grandmother, then the father, then the mother, and then he comes back to the time zone again. She's still there. She's looking a bit fuzzy, but she's still there. Doesn't like this. So he goes back and decides he's going to start killing Abraham Lincoln. He's then start going back killing major people in history, all the way back to killing Mohammed. Then he comes forward and he finds out that his wife is looking translucent, and so is the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he meets up with some other people who basically he realises have done the same thing, and he realises that all timelines are individual.
Mm-hmm.
You're only impacting your own timeline. You're not impacting anybody else's. So all the changes you make in history ripple down your timeline, but not necessarily anybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
So he met all these men that have killed Mohammed to basically try and change their timeline have only ended up basically disappearing themselves.
Mm.
So that's quite a memorable story. It's really quite a good one.
Mm.
It's quite good. Other one's 9 Yards of Other Cloth by Manly Wade Wilman. He generally wrote, I don't know this story at all, but he generally wrote horror and fantasy. That was in fantasy and science fiction. Rum Titty Chitty Tum Ta Tea by Fritz Lieber.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that one. Space to Swing a Cat by Stanley Mullen. Mm-hmm. Don't know anything about Stanley Mullen. Theory of Rocketry by C.M. Cornbluth. That I've Been Working On, dot, 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 by Anton Lee Baker. Another one I don't know. And Trigger Man by J.F. Bone.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of stories there that I really don't haven't come across.
Mm-hmm.
The one that stands out for me is The Man Who Murdered Mohammed, and I thought, really, that should really have won it.
Mm.
I think it's better than that Hellbound Train, but who's to know?
Mm.
Who's to know?
Mm.
So
we won't go over every category, I don't think. But one of the things I thought was interesting was that there was the Best New Author category, and it seems like no award won.
Yes.
Even though one of the authors in the list is Brian Aldiss.
That's odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
But also there's Kit Reid. Now, I don't know whether you know Kit Reid, because Kit Reid had been around for like 40-odd years and only died like in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm.
And I've read one or two of her works, and they were pretty bloody good.
Mm.
And she was just one of those authors that obviously was there all the way right through, but it never sort of crossed over onto my timeline. Mm. So, get back to her timelines again. Mm. No, it didn't really cross over to my sort of consciousness and never really picked up on it. Odd also that there are two nominees, Paul Ash and Pauline Ashwell, who are the same person. Russell George Brown, no, and Lewis Charbonneau, Lewis Charbonneau I had heard of, but Brian Ordis, for God's sake.
Yeah, yeah, you think he would have won.
You would have thought so.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's
really... got enough out by that stage to have an effect.
Yeah, that's really quite strange, isn't it? Yeah. Well, it also might be because he's English, British.
Yeah, that's true.
And this was an American convention.
Yeah, yeah.
Really don't know what the story was there. Doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. There was also no award given in the best movie, best professional magazine was Fantasy and Science Fiction, and best professional artist Frank Kelly Frias.
Mm.
Frank Kelly Frias is sort of synonymous with the work that was done in on Astounding covers and all that sort of stuff during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And so that was his first Hugo Award.
Yeah.
So a strong year.
Yeah.
I think they made a mistake on the novel.
Mm.
Novelette, absolutely and utterly. Thought it was great. But I think probably the best short story was not the right one.
No, possibly not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we mentioned last time that we just passed November 2019, which is a memorable date because it's the date in the future in which the movie Blade Runner is meant to be set. And it's quite interesting, really, isn't it, that in a lot of these movies, I'm thinking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, and this one, the people who write these movies sort of think that the future is going to happen a hell of a lot quicker than it actually has been doing. I mean, here we are in 2019, and the future is nothing like the one depicted in Blade Runner. As yet, you can perhaps imagine possibly another 50 years we might see something similar to that sort of environment. But, and it's certainly 2001, which came out, of course, pretty much the same year as the men landed on the moon, or it might be the year before. But that future of people having a lunar base and so on, and satellites and Pan Am flying you up into orbit and so on, that never happened by 2001, that's for certain. So, yeah, it's just interesting that we tend to be over-optimistic, I think, about the speed of change into the future. But anyway, so we're going to talk about both Blade Runner and its sequel, Blade Runner 2049. And so do you want to, Perry, do you want to talk about Blade Runner? I have a few things I'd like to say about it, but you can fire off if you like.
All right. Blade Runner, the original film, got a pretty poor reception when it first came out. I think more than anything because the producers... This was a film that basically was very, very different. We hadn't seen this future before in a film. This was very, very strange. And I think that the movie studios basically got a bit scared of it.
Mm.
They didn't know what sort of reception it was going to get. The initial response from people that they showed it to wasn't good. And yet, in hindsight, if you go back and have a look at it, you strip away all the artifice, all the stuff around the outside, and it's basically pretty much a classic noir plot.
Yes.
And it's a private detective, if you like, looking for somebody, trying to track somebody down. But it's just the world in which it's set, which is just so absolutely peculiar.
Mm.
Hadn't seen that at all.
Mm.
It reminded me after a while of Gibson's The Sprawl that came out in 1984. Now, I don't know whether Gibson was influenced by Blade Runner, but I can tell you that just about every other movie that came out post Blade Runner in the science fiction world was influenced by it. It's a really major, major film.
Mm.
And you think of that and you think of Alien and the work that was being done at that time has such a ripple effect all the way right through.
Mm. Well, of course, this is Ridley Scott again, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, the interesting thing about it, of course, is it's based on the book Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. You can totally understand the fact that a movie studio is not going to call a film Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. People are in the general Joe Bloggs out on the street is going to go, what the hell is this? So they called it Blade Runner. But if you actually go and have a look at the novel, the word Blade never appears, and Runner is only when somebody... just anyway, it might appear once. The term Blade Runner isn't there at all. Now, I was having a think about this, but I cannot find it anywhere. But I seem to recall reading at the time that the movie studio actually had purchased the rights to two SF novels at the same time. One of them was the Philip K. Dick book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And the other was The Blade Runner by Alan E. Norse.
Yeah.
Now, the Alan E. Norse novel is a novel set in the year 2014, which deals with the illegal supply of medical equipment for a rogue surgeon who's helping out people that are deemed not eligible for medical help.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was that they decided, for whatever reason, that the term Blade Runner was a good one that they could use on top of the film, but it seems to have no connection to it at all, and it's just quite peculiar.
The basic plot is pretty simple. Basic plot's pretty simple to understand. It's the basic plot's fairly straightforward in that there have been not quite a race of beings, but a group of androids created by the Tyrell Corporation, who are creating these simulated humans, if you like, who work as slaves or as soldiers, but they're very like humans, but because they need to keep them under control, the Tyrell Corporation has given them a limited lifespan of 4 years because they're scared of what they might do if they live longer than that. And there's a group of these replicants, as they're called, who've come to Earth, slaughtered some people on a spaceship, come to Earth, and they're really there to try and get in touch with the guy who's running the Tyrell Corporation and convince him to extend their lives. They don't want to die after 4 years, like no one would, of course. But they've kind of gone rogue, and they're quite dangerous. The film opens with a scene of one of these replicants killing someone who's trying to investigate him and determine whether he's human or a replicant, and the replicant kills him. And then we meet Decker, who's supposedly retired, but who is the person who hunts down these rogue replicants and kills them, gets rid of them. And so he's tasked with finding these four replicants who've landed on Earth. But the twist in the plot is that Decker is also introduced to a young woman called Rachel, and it fairly quickly becomes clear that Rachel also is a replicant, and who doesn't know it as the book opens. As the movie opens, she doesn't know that she's a replicant, but eventually does discover that she in fact is a replicant, and of course is devastated by this knowledge. And then the film plays out as to Decker hunting down these characters, at the same time falling in love with this character, Rachel, and what's he going to do about that? He really should be killing her too. And there's some interesting emotional tensions involved in the movie.
It's a very good film about what it is to be human.
Yes.
And it was stunning to watch, to look at, first off. I mean, basically the cinematography is just sort of astounding. There's a couple of little twee pieces in it which I really found a bit... when they're in the Bradbury building with some of those little almost automatons that are sort of wandering around. I thought some of that was a little bit... But other than that, I mean, that's sort of a very minor criticism of the whole overall thing. It's a classic noir plot. Harrison Ford is the perfect person for it because he's got that sort of face and he's got that sort of chiseled, worn down... noirish detective look about him. He fits it brilliantly, and he was on a high as well. I mean, he'd been doing some fairly big stuff at that time. You think about all those things that he was doing with after he appeared in American Graffiti, and then he was in Star Wars, and then he was in Indiana Jones, and how those last three novels, films, have rippled down through public culture all the way down through this period for the last 40-odd years.
He's been in some very significant films.
He has indeed, and it's really quite astounding. And so it's interesting that we're getting him coming back to all of these films as well. I mean, I know the Indiana Jones ones was a series going all the way right through, but he's come back into the the latest run of the Star Wars stuff. And he then comes back into Blade Runner 2049.
That's right. Before we get on to that, though, there are some really interesting things in the first movie. I mean, there's some great acting. You talk about Harrison Ford and the young woman who plays Rachel Sean Young as the actress. Also, I think is brilliant in the movie. But most of all is one of the replicants, Rutger Hauer. Would you say that's how you pronounce his name, Rutger Hauer?
Yeah.
And he's great. And of course, there's the famous classic death scene where he gives this speech called Tears, which is dubbed Tears in the Rain, and that really has become a classic. A piece of cinematography. It's brilliantly acted. The pacing of that is just very, 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 very well done.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
But some interesting things in it that having rewatched it recently, which I found really quite interesting. Firstly, I think we have to acknowledge that there's a fair bit of misogyny in the movie.
Mm.
For a start, Decker actually only successfully kills the female replicants before. He kills Zora and he kills Chris. But it's in fact Rachel who kills Leon. And of course, Decker never manages to kill Roy Batty. Who nearly kills Decker himself. So that's interesting. And I think there's a few disturbing things like that. There's the scene with Rachel where Decker kind of forces her to stay. She's going to run away from his apartment, and he kind of forces her back into this apartment, and then proceeds to start kissing her and paying attention to her, which I think is a bit strong by today's standards, I think. Anyway. But the other interesting, there's some interesting things in it. There's a bit. You remember the bit where Leon and Roy Batty get hold of the guy who's making the eyes. He's in this really cold environment, and they take off his cold suit. And it's just absolutely out of nowhere. Batty quotes this bit of poetry.
Fiery the angels fell. Deep thunder rolled around their shores. Burning with the fires of Orc.
Which is a lovely bit of stuff, but what's it got to do with anything?
What's it from?
It's actually from William Blake, and it's actually a butchered quote, because in the original William Blake it's Fire of the Angels Rose, but in Roy Batty's thing he goes Fiery the Angels Fell. Don't know whether that's a deliberate mistake or just a mistake, but it's out of a William Blake poem called America, a Prophecy, which is full of very, very strange. I mean, some of William Blake's stuff is very strange. But what is Batty doing saying that in the middle of the movie?
But there's connections there. American, a philosophy, a prophecy, when you're thinking about we're dealing with LA in 2019.
Yeah, that's it. But it's interesting. It's interesting. And then there's that silly bit where Decker zooms into the photograph, he finds this photograph and zooms into it and zooms into it and zooms into it and zooms into it. Perfect, absolutely infinite resolution in this thing.
Yeah.
And then there's a particular point where he keeps zooming in and he actually manages to look behind a piece of foreground furniture or something.
What?
And the other thing which I find really odd, which is kind of like a theme which runs through this movie and the next movie, is that Decker talks to people in English and they respond in a foreign language, different foreign languages, which he understands.
Yeah.
But the name is obviously understand his English, but they respond in their own language, That happens in both movies. It's really quite interesting. So I don't get that.
The original film, it's hard to know which one to which version to watch, because there was the original cinema release, and then there was a director's cut that came out later. And then a final cut that came out later on.
No, I didn't see the final
cut. I believe the final cut is the one that people say is the one that's closest to what Scott really wanted to deliver. Mm-hmm. But because he had to butcher it for the studio in the first instance, mm-hmm. and had to put a voiceover, mm-hmm. voiceover narration over the top, which I think is terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
It really ruins the film, because it basically sort of assumes that nobody can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They were obviously just scared that they had a lemon on their hands, and while it didn't do very well originally, it has become a cult classic. It's become a major classic film. And if you were to look at it now in terms of science fiction films of the 20th century, it's right up there, because it's got so many little bits and pieces in it that have just rippled down through the rest of the culture. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's certainly a classic. And then we move on to the sequel, which is Blade Runner 2049, which features Ryan Gosling as essentially a replicant, but a new model replicant who's no longer quite so dangerous. They have means of keeping them under control. And we start with him what's the term they use? Retiring? Retiring this old replicant who's living by himself as a farmer in some distant, remote locality. But then there's some interesting things happen about an old dead tree that's being propped up in this guy's backyard. And beneath the roots of the tree is a box buried deep. And inside the box are bones. And it gradually becomes clear that there's been a child born. The bones are of a woman who died in childbirth. But it turns out that mother who gave birth to the child was in fact a replicant herself. And so the idea that replicants can give birth is shocking to everyone. And it's either a miracle or it's something very odd going on. So that's where the movie starts. And then Kay goes on and investigates, and things come to light. So it's interesting. I don't like it anywhere near as much as the first movie. And the reason really is that it's quite a good action movie. It tries way too hard to be atmospheric. There's a whole lot of stuff in there which is just there purely for atmosphere. The whole business in the city, where he's trying to locate Decker, the Harrison Ford character. And he visits this city, which is apparently being hit by a neutron bomb or something, and it's been deserted. There's only Harrison Ford essentially is living in this city. But the atmosphere is a bit like Sydney at the moment. I think it's all orange skies and deep atmosphere. But there's kind of all this weird stuff in there. Like he's flying his little flying car, and there's all these huge, gigantic statues of naked women, some of which are broken apart and some of which are whole. And then he lands and he finds a bee landing on him, and there's this whole set of hives of bees. And again, what's it got to do with anything? And then he finally finds Decker and goes on from there. So it's interesting, and it connects interestingly with the first movie. But it tries too hard to be atmospheric. And then right at the end, I know I'm hogging the conversation here, Perry, I'll give you a chance in a moment, but right in the end I think it just descends into schmaltz. You know, the Americans love schmaltz, and the ending of this movie to me is just schmaltz. But you know, what the hell,
didn't you think the ending of the first one was?
No.
Well, he flies off into the sunset with it.
Well in the director's cut version I saw, he doesn't fly off into the sunset with her. They leave together. They leave his apartment together. But you don't know what the result's going to be.
Okay.
And in their minds is ringing the thing that the character Gaff says, which is, it's a pity she has to die, but then don't all of us. And that's kind of nicely ambiguous, I think, in that particular version. But yeah, in the cinematic release, they all fly off and they're all going to live happily ever after.
Well, I actually like it a lot more than you do. I can see this. Oh, there's some interesting connections between the two, because Ridley Scott acts as an executive producer, he probably had overall control over the whole thing. And it's got the same scriptwriter.
Ah, that's interesting.
A person by the name of Hampton Fancher, which actually sounds like a pseudonym, but I don't believe that it is. He wrote the original screenplay based on the original novel for Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and then it got changed, and it came back to him. But he's now credited as being the major scriptwriter of the first one, and also for the second one.
Yeah.
So there's a solid connection there. We've got the characters running through, so Ford is back.
Yeah.
And this whole thing, I don't think we can talk about this.
This
whole thing about, from the first one, was Harrison Ford a Rubicon or not? I've watched that film a couple of times, and I've gone there looking for clues. I can't find any. I think people just made it up.
No, Rachel once says to him, "Have you done this test which determines whether someone's a replicant or not? Have you done the test yourself?" And he actually doesn't answer that. So it's kind of deliberately ambiguous.
I think it's just a furphy.
But I think by the time we get to the second movie, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, in fact, it kind of doesn't work if he's not a real human. Because
that's right.
The whole premise of the second movie is a real human has had a child with a real replicant, someone who's definitely a replicant, and the child exists in the world. And so what is this going to mean for the whole race of replicants, as it were?
I liked the pacing of the second film. A lot of films that you see these days, especially if they are action or detective stuff, it's like bang, 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 bang. There's one cut, there's another cut, there's another cut. In this one, they hold the scene. Some of the ones you thought...
It's very slow.
It's slow pace, it's slow editing. But I didn't mind that. I went to see it in the cinema and it was really bloody loud when it was on there. And just watching it recently on the Blu-ray, it's pretty loud on the Blu-ray as well. But the score has basically, it sort of gives echoes of the score in the first film.
Which was by Vangelis.
It's by Vangelis. The second one wasn't, of course. But there's just a lot of things that hark back to the original. Opening scene.
I actually like the start of the second movie, but then to me it descends.
Oh, okay.
Well,
I just think there's a lot of things that are there. There's a character that's a replicant, or maybe a replicant, or at least she plays a prostitute who is very. I looked at her today and I thought, very similar to the character played by. Was it Daryl Hannah that played Chris in the first place?
Chris, yeah.
Yeah, Chris. So very, very similar to that. So there's a lot of there's a lot of pieces that go back from the 2049 back to the original.
Yeah.
And seeing the two of them together, certainly I think that the flow of it just goes all the way through.
Mm.
I think that there's the cinematography is truly excellent. I know you don't like some of it, but I do.
I think it's a beautiful film to look at.
Yes, absolutely. And it follows the approach that was held in that first one, so it carries on with the same sort of thing. We've moved further down into our eco catastrophe, and Los Angeles is now completely surrounded by walls on the seaside, so that the walls are, because the seas have risen up too much.
Yeah.
It's a shocking place to live in. It's just disgusting. The sprawl is still there. And it's actually gone a little bit further. That city sprawl that goes all the way through California seems to have evolved a little bit, but not too much. It's still recognisable as what it was from the original. So I thought it was a good sequel. It's very difficult to basically get to the point where you're going to do a really good film of an original.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the only one that I can really think of, and my kids will be all over me out of this because I keep on talking about it, is that Godfather Part 2 is probably as good as Godfather Part 1.
No.
But I don't know of any other sequels that are really quite up to it. When you've got the first one, which is iconic, what do you do with the second one? Yes, it may be down a little bit, but I don't have a problem with this film at all. I don't I don't feel that it is... I don't think it's a poor film by any stretch of the imagination. No, I think it's not really quite excellent.
But I enjoyed the start of it, but the ending I really thought was disappointing. Because the ending, we may as well give away spoilers, the ending is essentially Harrison Ford finally being introduced to his child. And poor old Ryan Gosling is kind of lying in the snow, dying outside while he does this. And that's the end of the film. Harrison Ford meets with his child. End of the story. And it just seemed to me to be very schmaltzy. Just, the tearjerker, here's the father who's been separated from his child ever since she was born.
I think you're being a bit too cynical about this. Sometimes I think a little bit of, I think endings like that are fine. I don't have a major problem with it. I hope they don't do anything else.
Oh, no.
I think they really do need to leave it there. It's done. Done and dusted. Now, the interesting thing, director of this, Villeneuve, also directed Arrival.
Oh, yes, which is very good.
Which I thought was very good, and I thought that actually was a better version of the material than the original story, but that's just my view, because a lot of people like the original story. I read the original. You haven't read it?
No, I didn't read
the story. I read the original, and I think now that I've seen the film, I could probably go back and understand what that was going on. Because it was, but he's a very good director. He also directed Sicario. I'm not sure if you know about that. This is basically a Emily Blunt. It's a sort of an action film set on the US Mexican border, where basically the authorities in the US do a raid into Mexico to basically arrest a drug pimp and to bring him back for trial and basically start a war, pretty much. It's quite a good action film, really quite excellent. I thought Gosling was great in 2049. I thought that he was a perfect foil for Harrison Ford, and to the extent that you could basically put them as father and son, almost, couldn't you? And I mean, there's a bit of a subplot in there that is he or isn't he? And Gosling's great in this. I think that I've seen him in a few things, and I've actually quite liked him.
As the First Man?
No, I still haven't watched that. I watched Drive, which I thought was quite good, but I haven't seen First Man.
It was interesting because I saw First Man quite recently. First Man is where it's a biopic about Neil Armstrong. And Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong as this very emotionally buttoned up character. And I thought there were a lot of similarities, really, because throughout 2049, he really is quite buttoned up. It's partly because he's supposed to be a replicant, an android. And his response is, really buttoned down because he can't afford to let his emotions out that he may have, and he keeps them right under control. So there's actually a lot of similarities in the emotional delivery of that character between those two films. So that was interesting.
Well, I think basically I enjoyed 2049. I can understand where people might think, maybe not. It's not up to the standard of the first one. I'm happy to admit that it isn't up to the standard of the first one. But as I said, hard to get up to that level of an iconic film like it did, but it did a pretty damn good job.
Fair enough. I enjoyed watching it, but as I say, I was just disappointed at the end because I thought it left a heck of a lot of questions unanswered. It's just this kind of, let's say, to me, overly emotional ending, which I didn't much like. But I could list all the questions that are left unanswered, but there's no point because no one's ever going to answer them. So it wasn't a bad thing.
It was good.
All right. Well, we might wind up there, and we'll see you in the new year. We'll probably, as I say, we'll do an episode where we review the best of our reading and watching during this year, 2019. Thank you, and we'll see you again. See you in the new year.
Thanks, David.
Okay.
See you.
Thanks, Barry.